Don't hold anything too tightly. Just wish for it, want it, let it come from the intention of real truth for you, and then let it go.
For me, our soul is like, it's unbound, it's limitless, but we will use words to limit ourselves.
When people stop believing that somebody's got your back or Superman's coming, we turn to ourselves, and that's where you become empowered.
Courageous participation attracts positive things.
I'm Gwyneth Paltrow, and this is the Goop Podcast, where we bring together visionaries, scientists, healers, artists, and seekers. I'm so grateful that I get to interview these extraordinary thought leaders and share their wisdom with you. And I love listening to the conversations that are led by my co-host and dear friend, Cleo Wade. Cleo is a beautiful poet and author. I deeply admire her and the way she keeps her heart open to the world. Together, we believe that engaging in open-minded, honest, and sometimes difficult conversations has the power to change our lives. All right, over to Cleo.
My guest today is Sahej Kohli. Sahej is the founder of Brown Girl Therapy, the first and largest mental health and wellness space for children of immigrants. Her new book is called But What Will People Say?, which is about belonging, family, and identity. Even if you aren't a child of immigrants yourself, it's really a book about stepping into your life by examining the narratives and stories that are holding you back. Today, Sahej and I talk about the idea of bicultural identity straddling, or the pressure to present different versions of yourself across multiple cultures, like with family versus friends. Sahej explains how emotional immaturity, the need for external permission, and the expectation to be exceptional is what she calls the three E's, and how they contributed to her struggles growing up as a child of South Asian immigrants. We also talk about all of the ways guilt shows up in complex family dynamics and why a pause or space can be a boundary too. Okay, let's get to my chat with Sahej Kohli. I want to thank you for writing this book. You're so naturally gifted as a teacher, and it's very hard to find books that are an invitation into an experience while also teaching the listener, even if it's not their experience, in a way that is so shame-free and almost as if it's an invitation to your own kind of really loving kitchen table conversation. And so I really enjoyed going through your book and kind of being, it feels like you're living in your book, not really reading it. And so I want to thank you for the style in which it's written and that invitation into this experience, because it was really so beautifully done and in such an informative and educational way.
Thank you for saying that. It was very hard to balance all of the like pieces I wanted to do in my book, the personal with the research, with the community stories, with the client stories. And it took many versions. So I appreciate that it delivered in the intent that was there. So
all of your writing is very relatable, even if you're not a child of immigrants. Although it reminds me of like people, you know, in Black community, if you like write a soul song or like a gospel song for Black church, but everybody feels it. and it's really, your writing is very much, you know, it feels so deeply intended for children of immigrants as this really healing, connective, communal tool, while really gifting so many people from a different background, a way to kind of understand trauma and their own childhood and their own family dynamics, and especially the disappointment of the parents. And I guess I'll start with this term you use called bicultural identity straddling. Because something I noticed in your book is that, you know, I think of code switching more of like how someone is from like work to personal. And something you really made me reflect on was this idea of how this personality or kind of sense of some type of self you go into to be with your family, and then it's a completely different person with your friends and your kind of chosen family. So can you talk to me about that?
Yes. I mean, that is the bicultural identity straddling is something that I think a lot of people deal with, right? When we think of culture, we think of culture as if I'm Indian and American, but we also all live within multiple cultural systems every single day. Just like you said, there's a workplace system culture, there's a family system culture, there's a family of origin system culture. If you have your own family, there's a friendship system culture. Like every space that you kind of exist in has a set of cultural norms, values, and expectations. So I think everyone to some degree kind of straddles these multiple cultures all the time. But specifically for children of immigrants and anyone who straddles more than one culture, so if you're biracial, multiracial, multicultural, those values, norms, and expectations are so diametrically opposed to one another that the tension is constant. And it doesn't matter, right? I'm a therapist now. I have done so much healing. I have done so much work, but I will still always feel like I am a different person to some degree in a different environment, depending on where I am. And I think what happens for so many of us, if we're not conscious about it, is that there's a performative sense of identity that we develop. So we develop performative behaviors, values, words, actions, choices that we make, all in the name of belonging and acceptance and validation. And if we're not conscious about it, that will just continue to go on for our whole life. And we will not ever know what we really want, what we really need, what is meaningful to us, what we require from our relationships, because we are so concerned about what, you know, pun intended here, other people might think or say about us, that we don't actually learn those things about ourselves. So I'm really hoping that this book can be a resource for people to question and interrogate some of those stories they're taught from a cultural standpoint. So if you're straddling more than one culture, I want people to question and interrogate, whose values am I living by right now? Why am I acting this way? Why do I feel the need to do this or say this? And that will really be so painful and difficult, because it might clarify relationships or expectations that aren't true to who we are. But in the name of all of that, we are going forward to a more authentic version of ourselves.
You know, I often think about, in my last book, I wrote about one day, my mom had recently given me this letter that I had written to her in second grade, that it must have been Valentine's, and we're making like a Valentine for your parents. And it was, you know, three ways you show love for your parents. It's just like kind of crazy handwriting. It's like, I show love for my mom by not talking when she's on the phone, by doing the dishes, by da 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 da. And in my book, I reflected on, you know, when does accommodation become the thing that makes us invisible? Because the love is given to us through praise, right? So when we say chasing belonging or validation, you know, the deepest kind of underlying foundation of that is love, right? It's like, oh, I get to be loved if I'm quiet, if I'm small, if I'm making life easier. And then as you take on this idea that love comes when I do these things, you think that you have to be doing to have love rather than being to receive love. And there's so much of that I felt in your book, because there is this space of, I get love with my grades being this, or my connection to, you know, if I'm anxiously attached to my parents, or, you know, all of these things. And I'd love to kind of understand, or you to share with our readers, when did the you that is with your friends and whoever that person is, this kind of liberated you, you know, what's a conversation that you're in the house, in your parents' family structure, you trying to get their love, and the person who's appreciated for who they are in the real world, what's the conversation they had to become one?
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. It took so much work. I don't know that it was one conversation. It was many different conversations between those parts of myself. And it took a lot. If I'm being honest here, it took me leaving and getting physical and emotional distance from my parents and my family and the community I grew up in order to figure out who I wanted to be versus who I was told to be. Yeah. And I think that was the beginning of that conversation between those two parts of me, where I started to realize there were pieces of myself when I was out in the world having that physical and emotional distance that weren't loved, that were deeply neglected because of the version of me who showed up at home or in my community or as a child. And it was through the work I was doing out in the world on my own with that physical and emotional distance, in therapy, building new friendships, having my own career, being financially independent, all of these things, where I started to tend to those neglected parts of myself. Mm-hmm. And I started to realize I needed to give love to those parts of myself in order to be able to go back to where I came from, to my family, to my cultural roots, to my community, and interact in a way that felt good to me and meaningful, because maintaining those roots were really important to me. Some people have that tension between those parts of themselves and say, you know what, screw it. I don't actually want to go back to that. I don't want to go back to that version of me when I'm at home, or the parts of me that were neglected. But I didn't want that. I wanted to find a way to merge them. And so some of the conversation that I had to have between those parts of myself were really, what are my values? What is important to me? What is it that I want? Because I needed to get clarity for myself. That's the only way for me to show up in spaces and say, I'm okay, I'm comfortable with this. If I can't get love in this relational context, I can give it to myself, and or I have other places I can receive that. And I think that is the hardest thing for so many of us to reconcile with, is that we aren't always going to be to get the love that we want in the ways that we want from the people that we want. Yeah. And that's just the nature of having many relationships, being in relationships with people with different value systems, different expectations, different cultural contexts. And that's where self-love is so important and so key, and yet so misunderstood, because often it is just focused on us as individuals rather than us as individuals and the roles that we play, which is the piece that I think I was missing. I love playing the roles I play. I love being daughter, aunt, you know, wife, sister, all of these things. But I can't really show up in those roles and be in those contexts if I'm not also taking care of myself. And so when you ask about those conversations, I really think I just needed to make room for myself to be with myself and to love myself before I could even go back and like reintegrate these roles and these other contexts of my life that I felt either neglected in or felt misunderstood in, quite honestly.
My girlfriends and I often talk about this kind of power of the pause, that, you know, when you suffer with like kind of the guilt of creating that space with you and your family, when you create long periods of space, or, you know, one of my best friends, Stevie, always says like, oh no, I like had to put her on pause. Because the thing also is that when you have narcissists in your family, you know, how narcissism, and not in that kind of like buzzwordy way of like how everyone's like gaslighting our narcissist now, and you're just kind of like, okay. But when you really have a narcissist in your family, something that they do is have a ton of presence in order to constantly control your narrative. And so sometimes the only way that you can take back your narrative or have real space to reflect and be like, wait, hold on, what just happened? What happened not only in our conflict, what has gone on to create our dynamic? If I'm kind of in community or in conversation or conflict with the narcissist in my family, like they'll try to call you 5 times, be like, talk to you, let's talk about this, or send you a million messages being like, why are you da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da? But really it's because there are, you know, narcissism is on shaky ground if they are not controlling the story. That is what feeds them. And so I found in your giving that space was actually the only way. And I'm not saying that your family members are narcissists or anything, but sometimes when you have that boundary, you know, the space, like space is a real boundary. And I think sometimes people want boundaries to always just be like, it's a conversation, but we stay in this exact dynamic. But at times, if you don't have time away for reflection, contemplation, and intentional kind of strategy for dynamic, you know, that is like sometimes the most critical boundary, but I think it carries the most guilt. Do you think?
I totally agree. Guilt is the number one topic I see in my clinical practice, in the Brown Girl therapy community, the stories I hear. It's all guilt, because so many people feel like they've been told to be one way, like you're saying, that narrative they've been fed and the story that they now tell themselves because of what they've been told about who they're supposed to be. And the minute they try to diverge and go off onto a different path, they feel so guilty. And it automatically becomes a black and white mindset. I'm betraying my family. I'm not a good enough kid because I'm doing this, or I don't deserve it. I don't deserve this thing I'm chasing because I'm not doing the thing that my parents wanted me to do. It always becomes these absolute catastrophes that the guilt will start to feed. Mm. And I totally agree that the pause is so important. I mean, we talk about boundaries in a Western world, and it's like, be direct, be explicit, be communicative. But that's not how boundaries work in systems, family systems that are hierarchical or patriarchal or have cultural contexts where direct communication isn't even used on a good day, right? There's cross-cultural communication matters. And so that space is a boundary, like you said. Behavior is a boundary, right? Not choosing not to pick up the phone. I was able to practice those types of boundaries when I got that physical distance. I was able to say, you know what? I'm actually not going to pick up the phone right now, and I'm going to call my mom back later or tomorrow when I feel like I'm in a better headspace or I can manage a conversation. And it's needing, having that space is so important, but there's so much guilt. There's so much guilt because distance for a lot of us equates, I don't love you or I don't want a relationship with you. And that automatically goes inward to say, I'm not good enough. I am doing something bad. I am bad because now I am taking the space.
Yeah.
So unlearning that guilt is so important. Guilt is just, it's like a yellow light. It's a sign that says, slow down. Think about why you're feeling this guilt, but it is not a neon sign that says, turn around. You need to turn around and backtrack and change your behavior. Sometimes, yes. Sometimes it indicates that we are doing something against our moral compass. But what I've seen in the research too, is that whose moral compass? In cultural context, whose social and cultural norms are you crossing? Is it your parents? Is it yours? Are you actually doing something harmful? Are you actually doing something wrong? Or do you just feel bad because it's new and unfamiliar? And often with the guilt with my clients and in the community that I serve, that is the key, is people feel like because it feels uncomfortable, it's bad. When in reality, it's uncomfortable because it's new. And it's learning to differentiate that for yourself.
Well, and it's like, you know, sometimes I think when it comes to boundary setting, when we view it as something that only kind of belongs in conversation, and then you have this expectation that then they will just do all the change so that you can just be you, that ends up becoming a letdown because I think two things happen. Like one, you over control and over strategize how people receive the information, right? So whenever you're overthinking, like, can they handle it? Can they not? What will they do with it? Then they're just going to do this. Or whenever you're kind of spiraling on reception of your truth, to me, that's always this like moment to be like, okay, hold on. Should my boundary just be an act? Like, do I feel that in conversation, I can be met with real like reception, understanding, or does my boundary merely need to be an action and not a conversation because people are who they are? And you know, people can change when they want to change, but you cannot change people. And so, you know, I feel like sometimes when I'm having those kind of reflective moments with my girlfriends, I'm being like, oh, I just can't decide, like, but I just feel like it's not that I feel that someone won't understand the boundary I'm trying to put down. It's that it actually is in the same vein of what you're saying, like, can be covered in like complete and utter misunderstanding that is like just too frustrating that instead you're like, oh no, I just won't go there for that day. And that is just the boundary. And it's like, must be pretty clear that that's just not what I'm doing because it's not what I'm doing. And I think that boundary can be easier felt than heard.
Absolutely. And that actually, I think, is more of an invitation for the other person to reflect on what is actually happening and their role in it, if they so choose, right? If you choose not to go home or go to that event for that day, that is more of an invitation for that person to say, huh, I wonder why they didn't come to this. I'm wondering if it's something I did. I mean, and not everyone's going to have the emotional maturity to have that. So it still allows you to protect yourself. But yeah. I totally agree. A lot of times, if we're only viewing boundary in one way that it needs to be set in communication, we are taking away our own agency to be able to do other things to set boundaries that we need.
Let's take a quick break to talk about one of our partners.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Acer bag collection in its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Acer is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and the 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Acer collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
Okay, let's get back to the conversation.
You know, one thing that you said in the book that I also thought was so interesting was the three E's.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I feel that, you know, when we go into like this idea of this misunderstanding, You say, as I look back on this time in my life, I can pinpoint that my struggles were due to a combination of what I call the three E's: the need for external permission, emotional immaturity, and expectation of exceptionalism. Can you kind of take us through how these manifested for you, and then kind of what you all also, how you, I think, arrived at such a kind of, you know, not, it's a complicated idea put very simply, and how you've woven healing into these by being able to label them?
That is also a great question that I haven't fully explored, but I'm going to try to do that here. I will say, to preface this, writing this book was so healing in so many ways. I think
even you can feel that as the reader.
Yeah, even if no one reads it, which obviously I want people to read it, but even if no one did, I gained so much personally from just excavating so many of these like old wounds and old experiences and revisiting them and interrogating them and rewriting them for myself. And I think that is what happened in that specific chapter you're talking about, where I do revisit my academic failures and my struggles and my mental health. And I was able to say, huh, I play a role in my experiences. I'm not to blame for struggling, right? Struggling is not a moral failure. I'm not to blame for needing more support or needing more time to figure things out. But I also play a role in how I handle things or how I wasn't ready to handle things. And I think in writing the book, that's something I really came to, was just owning a sense of, I think a part of owning our sense of agency is also owning our responsibility and accountability in the experiences we have. And so when I say the need for external permission, up until maybe my mid-20s, if I'm being honest, my whole life was, what is it that my parents want from me? What is it that other people want from me? As a woman, as an Indian woman, as an Indian daughter, as a daughter of immigrants, like all of these intersection of identities, I had been conditioned to believe that other people knew best. Maybe because my parents were scared for me, worried, wanted my safety and security and all of these things, or maybe because I just wasn't trusted to be able to make decisions, whatever it was. And I just realized that I never really had my own compass and guidance, self-inflicted guidance to make decisions and decide for myself, which is why when you read the book, there are so many years of just pain and struggle because I didn't know how to get out of it. And I think a part of that healing from the need for external permission was just, again, making space for myself and saying, it's okay if I make mistakes. It's okay if I make a choice and then I change my mind later, or I don't really like that I made that choice and I get to own it and have accountability for it. Almost turning to other people to help make choices for me was a way for me to escape accountability for making choices for myself. And I think that's something I've really started to acknowledge, is you can't just have agency with making decisions and saying, this is what I want. You have to have agency when it comes to accountability for whatever the repercussions are for those choices and decisions you make. You don't get it one way.
Yeah.
And when I think about emotional, you know, maturity and my lack of emotional maturity for, again, many decades of my life, I think a part of that comes from not being taught to be critical or like analyze things or make choices for myself. I think they go hand in hand, where a lot of it is, I knew the role I had to play. I knew the lines I had to say. I knew what I needed to do. And that was it. There was no sense of, it's okay if I make mistakes. It's okay if I make the wrong choice. It's okay if I don't know. And I think emotional maturity is about being able to handle those difficult emotions when things don't go according to plan. And I didn't know how to do that. And so I think that was something that I really learned only later in life. And then when I think about exceptionalism, I think there are many groups in especially this country that are expected to be exceptional. There's the model minority myth for Asian Americans. There's all of the post-Civil War immigration laws that changed that allowed a wave of Indian immigrants, South Asian immigrants, to come to this country. And a lot of that was where my history in this country is rooted in. Is this idea that, you know, my dad was allowed to come to this country, was welcomed in because he's a doctor and could be of service to this country. And then he had a son who decided to be a lawyer. And then they had a daughter who decided to pursue fashion and excel in it. Then they had another daughter who struggled. And that was like mind-blowing for them. They were like, we've done everything right to set you up here. And you're struggling and we don't understand that. We just don't understand. We can't conceptualize that. And I think the need for exceptionalism can be really suffocating and really isolating for many people who grow up in situations where they're not allowed to struggle and they're not allowed to experience something differently than the people around them.
You know, I often think about, as a recovering perfectionist myself, you know, if I think about it, if I had to talk to another person who's struggling with that, I would tell them that, you know, motivate out of perfectionism by knowing that it removes you from your humanity. It removes you from the human experience of being flesh and bones. And even we like to be like, oh, embrace our flaws, but we don't even know if they are flaws. It's just human. It's just, you know, we don't think that a flower is flawed because it grows, you know, to the left and one grows straight up and one grows to the right. You just think it is what it is. And I think whenever we, you know, being a perfectionist is an out-of-body experience. And so, you know, I think that, and obviously it's a response to, you know, trauma and it's a response to so many different things and or a survival response to our world or, you know, American capitalism and all these things. But most of all, what it does is says, leave your body, turn it into a machine, go for this thing. And then at some point, spirit, soul, your, you know, mind and heart connection is like knocking and knocking and knocking and knocking and then pounding. And I think that that is what creates such, whether it's breakdowns or breakthroughs for people.
I totally agree. And I think, you know, if your whole identity is a pie and that whole pie is only one thing that you think you need to do or be, of course, it's going to be like an unstable ground that you're walking on and living on. And that's why all of those pieces in the pie need to be different things: play, mistakes, fun, you know, experience, learning skills, all of these things that just relationships, all of these things that just need to fill our, I'm to stay on analogy, to be the pie, the whole pie. It's so important because, like you're saying, I think, I mean, I struggle with perfectionism still to this day. I'm still unlearning it, even with this book and this process. It's an ongoing journey where it's taking me, as you said, out of my body, and I'm not able to stay present and enjoy what's actually happening in the moment. So I'm too worried about either what I did or what I'm going to do.
Yeah, that is such a reminder that there's kind of no there with any of these things. So, you know, whether it's the kind of, you know, bicultural identity straddling that creates self-betrayal, you know, you can find a flow where you're like the boundaries working, the boundaries working, the boundaries working, and then like one big thing happens, whether it's a funeral or this or that, and then, you know, it really kind of makes your current boundaries that are protecting your integrity irrelevant. And then I'm in different terrain all of a sudden, and it's not really working. And you have to kind of go back. And, you know, something you, I, it's funny because you said this in your previous response, and but I wrote it down when I was looking through your book, interrogating our narratives. Do you think that even now, if you fall into a space where you're tight roping between your kind of family dynamic or, you know, your current chosen family dynamic where things are more high integrity or in flow, whatever they are, when you're trying to get back to self, or you know, you kind of fall off your course, do you find that you begin by interrogating your narrative again? And how would you kind of tell someone how they can begin the process of interrogating their narratives?
It's super heavy work and it's hard, and it's not a one-time thing that you do. I think you're spot on that for me, it's constant. Interrogating our stories are and our narrative, it's constant because we are being fed different stories every day in all of our experiences. And so it's not meant to be this, you always have to be on interrogating, but I think that we owe it to ourselves in any which way that is meaningful to us to make space for ourselves, to be able to interrogate our narrative. And for some people, that can be running. For some people, that can be journaling. For some people, that can be whatever it looks like where you feel like you're able to get out of your head and into your body and really sit with whatever's coming up for you. Some people, that's coming to therapy. I think a part of interrogating our narratives is we know, our bodies know when we're in misalignment. They just know, right? I don't think that there's like a thought you have or a feeling you have where you're like, oh, all of a sudden I need to start like interrogating my narrative. I think that that's too simplified. I think your body just knows. You either, you know, I think your body either starts to shut down a little bit, or you're getting burned out, or you're feeling really resentful, or you're feeling like rageful and you don't know why, or you're starting to feel these emotions that maybe you don't have words for. But whatever happens, your body knows. Your body, you know, you feel it in your stomach, you feel it in your chest, you feel it in your head, you feel it in your back. Your body knows when you're misaligned with whatever is happening around you, or the relationships you're engaging in, or the conversations you're happening. And that is when you need to just take time to interrogate, whose stories are you absorbing right now? Whose narrative are you trying to force yourself to live by? Does it feel, you know, authentic to you, accurate to you, healthy for you? Does it not? We are allowed to change our narratives at any point in life. That's the thing of that's the beauty of our stories, is that you can change your mind. You can go back. You can, you know, decide to do something totally off the track. It doesn't matter. And I think when it comes to interrogating our stories, it's more about just being honest with ourselves about what we're feeling. So much of that work is emotion regulation work, is understanding what we're feeling, why we're feeling it. And I say all of this with the caveat, because I love these conversations, but I often like to put in a caveat that we are also not projects that need to be constantly worked on. So I think like a lot of my book is the how and what of why of my story and what I'm seeing in this community that is so underserved. And it's okay to just be. It's okay to just be, because a part of interrogating our stories and doing this work is still doing. And sometimes I find that that intellectualization is the very thing that is keeping us from being in our bodies and in the moment, because we're so concerned with, oh, I need the language for this, or I need to understand why this is happening, or I need to understand, you know, X, Y, and Z. And sometimes we need to just not worry about understanding it and just feel it and sit in it and figure out how to move through it.
Yeah, I think there's such an incredible harmony to be found in it's not that deep. You know, I think that's like some of the best advice a friend could ever really give you is to like give you permission to dismiss certain things. And I was actually just talking to someone the other day about how, you know, I look forward to like kind of harmonizing our mental health era with like the great ending of the overthinking every single thing, because so much of what is really belaboring us is that we are overthinking every single thing, forgetting that most of us are so wrapped up in our own lives that nobody is thinking about us or whatever it is as much as, but you know, we're looking at ourselves all day and we're like, you know, we're thinking that everyone's noticing if our eyebrows are a certain way or if our, you know, whatever we're talking about or however we're hoping to be perceived. Meanwhile, we're just living in this kind of era where everyone is so in their own story that there's not a lot of perception happening anyway because no one's overthinking you. And I just think that, you know, to be able to dismiss certain things is that is actually a very is a is the kind of next breath of fresh air.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that translates to like when the conversation we were having around boundaries too, right? And you had mentioned in your last question in the beginning about how sometimes you could do all the right things and you can be in flow, and then all of a sudden it's one thing that just like tears you down or activates you or makes you feel like you are your previous version of yourself who didn't know how to handle this thing. And I think in those moments, letting it go is sometimes the best action that you can take. For instance, I was home with my family, and I have a better relationship with my family now and my parents, but my parents had said something and I can't remember what it was, and I felt so defensive and so activated by it. And I remember being like, oh, when is it just gonna get easier for me to just handle these moments? And I remember just telling myself, it's fine. Like, we can't it just let it go. Like, this is those moments where getting defensive actually is the thing that I don't want to do, or even acknowledging that is the thing I don't want to do here. I just want to let it go. And I did. Done with my day, and it was fine.
You know, there's this little cartoon I wrote in my first book, and it's two little stick figures talking to each other. And this has actually happened to me in conversation one day, whereas I said to somebody, and so the one little stick figure says, "How am I going to explain this to people?" And the other stick figure says, "You're still explaining yourself to people?" And I remember, and that actually, I'll never forget sitting across from somebody who said that to me. And And they kind of like giggled as they said it. And this kind of very like Buddhist kind of spiritual kind of, you know, that how in like Stoicism or Buddhism, there's just this like dismissal of that kind of frenetic, anxious, self-centered ideas. And I always kind of hit pause on myself, because that inner boundary, the pause within, is important also. When you're over explaining or over, you know, I can always tell when I'm like, God, if I can't get this into one sentence, and it's like, and I think that if I just did this and this and this and this and this to kind of like make my case about why I need something. And recently I had this in my own therapy where I kind of realized that I was like, wow, you are actually allowed to value what you want as much as what you need. And that I felt that a lot when I was reading your book, because it is this idea that, you know, what you want can be as valuable as what you need. And I think that a lot of the times we attach all of this kind of over kind of like, it's not just like an overthink, but it's a ton of justifications, and it's really murky, and it's really like musty, and it's just like a lot of junk, because we're trying to allow what we want to become a need and bribe ourselves into it being a need, when really there's a firmness and a real self-worth we can get to, where you can just say, no, I just don't want to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and instead of being like, well, I can't do that anymore because they we're trying to alchemize it somehow into a need. And you're like, no, it can be, it's actually just a plain old want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, over-communication can very much be a sign of low self-worth, self-esteem, low self-confidence, because it alone reinforces this belief that you need other people to validate what it is that you want. Yet you need to prove it to other people that it's worthy in order for them to give you the external validation, right? Because your internal validation isn't enough. And when we build those levels of confidence and those self-esteem and those self-worth, and we start to like give ourselves, as you said, the internal pause to think about these things for ourselves, it becomes more and more apparent. And when you make decisions for yourself, no matter how much it might feel it's life or death in relationships, no one else really cares that much. Like, we're all so absorbed with ourselves. And at the end of the day, our egos, I mean, in a world where we have social media the way we do and the internet the way we do, our egos are just so big that we start to convince ourselves that we need to make sure everyone is always on board with what we are doing, when at the end of the day, people really don't care all that much.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really care about what you're doing or the choices you're making or what you want. But I mean, that's something I've had to unlearn in a cultural context where I was taught that my relationships with other people are more important than my relationship with myself. It took me years to learn this idea that I can actually just do that for myself and it doesn't matter. But the thing is in order to get there, people have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable, because it can be uncomfortable to be like, well, maybe someone will be disappointed by this. Maybe someone will not understand this. And it's a form of impression management, which is what I talk about in my book, this idea that we constantly want to manage other people's impression of ourselves, when in reality, we should just be able to build that confidence for ourselves to say, I'm making this choice because of this for myself, and that's enough. And I can decide later how I'm going to live with it, what I'm going to do, if I'm going to change my mind, if I'm going to change course, and that's enough.
And my validation of self is as valuable as whatever I think your validation of my life is, if not maybe even more, because no one knows me like me.
Exactly. No one knows what is happening in the internal worlds of everyone else like that person living with it.
You know, something you talked about in this book that really struck me was validating that this going through and validating our memories. And, you know, I just hadn't seen this written in this way. And, you know, you talk about how, you know, you can have this kind of perceived reality that is real. And it's not even just a perceived reality. It is your reality of what your dynamic was like or what your parent was like, or, you know, and they have a completely different one. I often hear my mom say this about her dynamic with her sisters, where they're just like, God, they just like act like our childhood was like so rough. And I just like, didn't like, I thought it was fine. I like thought our parents were great, you know, and they have a completely different, you know, had a completely different experience. Mm-hmm. Can you take me through how, you know, we can validate each other's memories or hold space for these different experiences so that we can, at the end of the day, find some type of connection with each other so that our past, because I actually felt that in validating our memories, I was like, wow, there's so much disconnection because of people cannot agree on the way the past was and what it kind of did to and how it harmed each of them in their own different ways, or didn't harm some and harmed others. Mm-hmm. And if we could do this, then like, this is such a point of connection for so many people I know.
Yes. Yes. I mean, this is something that comes up all the time in the past family counseling work I've done and in the couples work I do now, which is what I heard you say when you talked about your mom being like, well, we have such different experiences and I don't remember it like that, is that both people want to be heard. Both people want their perspective and perception of what happened to be heard. There is a parallel process happening almost all the time in relationships when there is tension and disconnection. Often both people are feeling similar things, maybe for different reasons, but it's that feeling that we want to like zoom in on and say, I actually feel like I'm not being heard. I wonder if this person is also not feeling heard. And we have to remember that validation is not the same as agreeing with someone. And I think people really confuse the two. Just because you validate someone else's feelings or thoughts or experiences doesn't mean you agree with it. I can, you know, fight with my husband and we can talk about how we both perceived something. And I can be like, our realities can be totally different. But at the end of the day, I can say, that sounds like you were frustrated because you, you know, because of this,
yeah,
or
yeah.
It sounds like that was really like isolating for you that I didn't respond that way. And I can validate that he's feeling a certain way and I can share what I'm feeling and he can validate that. And that's going to be the thing that brings us together, because emotional connection is not about agreeing or finding out who is right and who is wrong. It's figuring out how to create space for all of these different feelings and thoughts and experiences to live at the same exact time.
Yeah.
And so when I work with people who struggle to validate other people's experiences, often that's what's happening, is that they are feeling so defensive of their side of things not being heard and felt that they can't even make space to validate that the other person is feeling and thinking something different. And
yeah.
So if we want to connect those two, we have to make space to both process what we're feeling so we're not projecting it onto the other person, while also receiving what that person is saying and recognizing it's not necessarily personal. Right? We all kind of want to be right. But I think of it like, if you're sitting at a table, when you're sitting across from someone, oftentimes it can feel like you're just figuring out who's right and wrong. And you're fighting at each other, talking at each other. And I like to use the analogy of like, one of you just move over to the other side of the table, you know, sit side by side, you're closer together, and you approach this problem that's in front of you together, rather than against one another.
Mm-hmm.
And it's finding that level of allyship in the relationship that I think is really important. I've had to remind myself multiple times, it's not about being right. It's about being someone who can be kind and receive these feelings and respect them, even if I don't agree with them. And it's very, very different.
And sometimes you can do this in order to connect, and sometimes you can do this as a peaceful way to disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think sometimes when you're going through, you know, whether it's a friendship breakup or a relational breakup, or you had to fire somebody or whatever, it's liberatory to allow them to have their side of the story and to know that, like, in the dynamic, you may always feel that you did your best, or you may only see what you did to provide the best possible environment for this relationship to flourish. And they may just only have a story or experience that it was a place that was impossible for them to flourish because of you. And that could be because of their experiences or your experiences or your traumas or your this or your that or what it triggers, your whatever it is. But it is a true act of liberation for yourself to say, you know what, they get to have their side of the story, and I don't need to control someone else's vision of a version vision of me.
Yes, exactly.
And that's hard.
It's super hard. I mean, none of it is easy, because we all as humans want to feel like seen and heard and right. And we want to solve problems, right? Our brains are wired for like solutions. But at the end of the day, sometimes the solution, as you said, is allowing these multiple things to be true at the same time and accepting that it's not going to have a pretty bow wrapped up in it, and we're all going to get on the same page. And if you're so concerned about changing other people's story of something, you're not living in yours. You're not living in your own story of your life and what it is that you can do and what you have control over and how you can manage what's coming up for you.
Your book is this The word empowering is a little cringe, but it is truly this really empowering guide to really kind of stepping into your life by releasing this desire to control so many things. And I feel, I mean, we talked about so much, but I have four more pages of questions that I didn't get to ask, but I just want to thank you so much for your time and for writing this and for your Instagram Brown Girl Therapy, which I know helps so many people, and your advice column. And I'm so grateful. And I really hope that, everyone can read this book regardless of your background, because there are so many tools for family dynamic and self-liberation in here that I know that every person could benefit from. So thank you so, so much for this book.
Thank you so much for having me on and for this conversation and for reading and enjoying it and telling me you enjoy it. I'm just so happy for it to be out in the world. And I really do hope, like you said, it's a guide, a compass, a resource that people can turn to over and over again.
It will be. It definitely will be. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Sahej Kohli. I hope you'll pick up a copy of her new book, But What Will People Say? And learn more about Brown Girl Therapy by heading to @browngirltherapy on Instagram.
This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. I hope you'll listen, follow, rate, and review all of our episodes, which are available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Odyssey, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening to the Goop Podcast.